welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, April 5th, 2021. I'm your reader, Ralph Skippers. In looking at today's front page, there are headlines, Local Company Invests in Clean Manufacturing, and Dubuque County Couple Nears 65 Years. But today, we're going to start with Iowa Ethanol Bill Draws Bipartisan Support, Oil Industry Opposition. It would require new gas station infrastructure to support at least 10% ethanol products and limit the number of pumps that deliver traditional gasoline, by Benjamin Fisher. Several area lawmakers in the Iowa legislature have advanced a bill that would mean major changes to rules regarding ethanol in gasoline and what customers would see at the pump. Iowa House of Representatives Study Bill 185 passed the House Ways and Means Committee last week with some bipartisan support. It would require that new gas station infrastructure support at least 10% ethanol products and that fewer pumps deliver gas with no ethanol. It would also create seasonal biodiesel standards, among other things. The bill originated as a session priority of Governor Kim Reynolds, but looked very different when it passed the committee than when it was proposed. Republicans amended the bill with a strike-after amendment, which rewrote much of the language just before the committee's vote. We had looked at it and probably spent 2 full weeks talking to different groups about it, said Iowa Representative Lee Hine, Republican from Monticello, who chairs both the House Ways and Means and Ag Committees. We've listened to most every group that is a stakeholder in this policy. Hine said he and Iowa Senator Dan Zumbach, a Republican from Ryan, have worked together with the opposed industries to find some common ground. Zumbach did not respond to requests for comments for this story. The cornerstone of the resulting amended legislation is that a 10% ethanol standard becomes the law of the land in Iowa. If the bill's enacted, the E10 standard will come into effect upon enactment, Hine said. Basically, that's what's already offered at every retail station in the state. The E0, the premium no ethanol gasoline, will need a special use label on it denoting that it's for motorcycles, chainsaws, lawnmowers, older vehicles, stuff that runs better on that. The bill also raises that standard to E15 in 2028. Hine said the language allows some exceptions for smaller retailers. For the smaller stores, where infrastructure is not up to snuff, we've provided a waiver they can get from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, Hine said. Our goal was never to put anybody out of business. We just want to gently nudge them to sell biodiesel and biofuels. That nudge is not gentle enough, though, for the opposed industries. Every oil and gas station lobby in the state opposed the bill. Iowa Representative Lindsey James, a Democrat from Dubuque, voted in favor of the bill in committee, but said the industry opposition was adamant. It has extremely significant opposition, obviously, from the petroleum industry, she said. Those who critique it are meddling in the free market. Iowa's renewable fuel industry is behind the bill in a big way, including companies in the area such as Western Dubuque Biodiesel. General Manager Tom Brooks argued that the bill actually loosens restrictions for the customer. Right now, you're being told that you can get, at most, 10% ethanol, he said, so you are getting mandated to have 90% gasoline. Brooks added that he thought the move would be good for Iowa's economy. I currently ship a lot of product out of state, he said. This would mean my product could be kept in state. The money would be kept here rather than sending that more inexpensive fuel to distributors in other places. Hine, too, admitted that the standard language rubbed some members of his caucus the wrong way. We're probably going to have a discussion about that, he said. Some see a standard as a mandate. On the flip side, there are a lot of things we pass in this chamber that we don't realize are truly mandates. We mandated insurance companies to pay the same amount to telehealth claims as they did for inpatient office calls just a few weeks ago. James said her support for the bill to get it out of committee was just to keep the conversation going, understanding that given how new it was, the language was likely to change before a House floor vote. I voted for the bill knowing that it was an unfinished piece of legislation and there would be a lot of amendments moving forward, and knowing that the changes to it would likely make it stronger, she said. I know, as Iowans, we want to make sure that we're moving in a climate-friendly direction. Climate change is real. Science has solutions. Renewables are a part of that solution. As the bill also includes tax incentives for gas stations, the bill is subject to ways and means and, thus, not subject to funnel deadlines like most bills are. It therefore can take its time moving through this session. Next from the front page, local company invests in clean manufacturing. Maquoketa manufacturer completes a capital improvement project that allows it to meet the evolving needs of customers, by Jeff Montgomery. A Maquoketa manufacturer has completed a capital improvement project that allows it to meet the evolving needs of customers. Dynamic Tube recently launched an industrial clean line and inspection facility within its facility at 1286 East Maple Street, according to Business Development Director Brian Deans. Dynamic Tube manufactures and fabricates high-performance tubing and pipe parts used in engine, fluid, and hydraulic systems by original equipment manufacturers in the agriculture, construction, mining, railroad, and defense industries. Producing clean parts for these clients is essential. Deans explained that even minuscule parts of dirt and grime have the potential to damage the internal workings of an engine or piece of machinery. By investing in ways to create cleaner parts, officials at Dynamic Tube believe they can meet the needs of existing clients and position the company to land new ones. The standards for cleanliness are getting more stringent as time goes on, he said. This is a response to what our original equipment manufacturer customers are telling us. Parts now go through three basic steps at Dynamic Tube. First, they are sent through a five-tank clean line system, Dean said. Along the way, parts will get progressively cleaner as they are dipped and flushed in these tanks. Next, the parts are sent to an inspection room and examined under a newly acquired industrial inspection microscope. It's not enough just to clean them, Dean said. You have to inspect them and make sure they are clean. Finally, the parts are capped and sealed inside the inspection room, which features an air filtration system that prevents dust from being reintroduced to freshly cleaned parts. Dean said the company invested about $250,000 on the project overall. He views it as a worthwhile expenditure. Overall, the industry is trending this direction, he said. For a company our size, I think we are ahead of the curve. Dynamic Tube has been in operation since 1976. It now employs about 65 workers. The business can be reached at 563-652-5165. And finally from the front page, Dubuque County couple nears 65 years, by Annie Mail. Love That Lasts series is a series highlighting local couples who have been married for at least 50 years. A new story will be shared each Monday at telegraphherald.com and in each Tuesday's print edition. Dateline, Farley, Iowa. Joan and Gerald Gull's paths first crossed at a 4th of July picnic in 1951 in Holy Cross. Although they noticed each other, neither said a word to the other. Months later, they both ended up at a picnic on Labor Day in New Vienna. This time was different. Joan's sister wanted to go to a dance afterward, and Joan knew her mom would force her to go along. Gerald decided to drive Joan, her sister, and other friends to the dance. When they headed out, Joan hopped in the front seat next to him. Neither Joan nor Gerald remember if they danced together that night, but afterward, he started driving to Luxembourg to call her. "My folks didn't have a telephone, and I called her up from Luxembourg," Gerald said. "I called her for a date, and she said, 'I'm all booked up this week.' Sometime later, I called her up and asked her again for a date. After his second call, she agreed to go. The two went to see a movie in Dyersville. I remember several weeks later, I asked her if she wanted to be my girlfriend, and she said, 'Yeah,' Gerald recalled. Soon after, Gerald went to France to serve in the U.S. Army and was gone about 2 years. After he returned, he and Joan dated for two more years before marrying on June 12, 1956. They are still side by side more than 64 years later. After marrying, they purchased a dairy farm in Bankston, worked there together, and raised their 10 children: Mary Jo Scott, Jim Gall, Julie Culbertson, Lori Fallon, Kathy Ehrlich, Diane Brimeyer, David Gall, Vicki Gall, Ken Gall, and Carrie Evanarius. They farmed for 35 years before retiring and moving to Farley. But even in their retirement, they are far from bored. Their 10 children, 29 grandchildren, and 27 great-grandchildren keep them busy. Their granddaughter, Kimberly Reinert, said when she thinks of the couple, she sees two people who have overcome every obstacle thrown at them. It is about 10 years ago now. We as a family spent the entire Sunday making 98 apple pies with Grandma and Grandpa, Reinert said. We all had our own jobs. That was just a testament to their marriage. They each have their own part, and it works like a well-oiled machine. They get it done and get through it together and enjoy their time together. Joan said some of the best memories she and Gerald have together are times they drove to local dance halls, and their favorite was Melody Mill in Dubuque. She remembers dancing the foxtrot and square dancing with Gerald and friends. It was just a special dance hall, she said. We changed partners and danced together, and most of the people were all friends, and we just had the best time. That is a memory that will stick with us. Their son, Ken Gall, said his parents' 64 years of marriage is impressive, but the fact they have been married for so long and raised 10 kids is a remarkable feat. At weddings, we usually do a wedding dance and someone asks who has been married 10 years, 20 years, and so on, he said. They always seem to be the last ones out on the dance floor. It always puts a grin on my dad's face. They just glow when that happens. Joan's nephew, Kevin Kramer, said that he was always welcome in Gerald and Joan's home when he was growing up. I would always stay there during the summers, and they didn't bat an eye, he said. They were so amazing. My mom was always like, she's got enough kids, but Joni was always like, oh, sure, come on. They've always been a constant in my life. Joan and Gerald's daughter, Kathy Ehrlich, said their hospitality and unconditional love are two of the traits that many people admire about them. Their faith is strong, and family is very important, she said. We still get together for holidays, which, with the size of our family, that's like over 85 people. Everyone tries to make it. They just love to see everybody. Kayla Silvers, one of Joan and Gerald's grandchildren, said the phrase that comes to mind when she thinks of them is one Gerald says frequently. It's better to have your hands full than empty, Silver said. I think that exhibits so many things about their marriage. You can tell what makes them happiest is having the presence of a large family. Joan said seeing the 80-plus family members again after the COVID-19 pandemic is over is what she and Gerald look forward to most. That will be the joy of our lives, she said. Next in today's almanac, today is Monday, April 5th, the 95th day of 2021. There are 270 days left in the year. On this date, in 1621, the Mayflower sailed from Plymouth Colony in present-day Massachusetts on a month-long return trip to England. In 1792, President George Washington cast his first veto, rejecting a congressional measure for apportioning representatives among the states. In 1887, in Tuscumbia, Alabama, teacher Ann Sullivan achieved a breakthrough as her six-year-old deaf-blind pupil, Helen Keller, learned the meaning of the word water as spelled out in the manual alphabet. In 1951, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were sentenced to death following their conviction in New York on charges of conspiring to commit espionage for the Soviet Union. And in 1955, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill resigned his office for health reasons. This almanac provided by the Associated Press. And next from the Dubuque page, 19 more COVID-19 cases in Dubuque County. The Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and vaccination. Sunday's developments included 19 more Dubuque County residents were confirmed to have COVID-19 during the 24-hour period. By 5 p.m. Sunday, 67,893 residents in the Telegraph Herald coverage area had been fully vaccinated. Dubuque County had a 14-day positivity rate of 3.9% as of 5 p.m. Sunday. Rates for other area Iowa counties were Clayton County 1.8%, Delaware County 5.5%, Jackson County 4.3%, and Jones County 3.6%. The state did not provide new county-level hospitalization data on Sunday. As of Thursday, 5 Dubuque County residents with COVID-19 were hospitalized. One such resident each of Delaware, Jackson, and Jones counties were hospitalized as of Thursday. No such residents of Clayton County were hospitalized. Statewide, Iowa reported 405 additional COVID-19 cases as of 5 p.m. Sunday, for a total of 353,280. The state reported no additional related deaths, so the death toll remained at 5,822. As of 5 p.m. Sunday, 662,885 Iowans had been fully vaccinated, an increase of 10,536 from Saturday. In Wisconsin, Grant County health officials recently changed the way they report COVID-19 data. Officials stopped reporting the number of recovered individuals and total confirmed positive individuals to date, so the number of active cases no longer can be determined. The state reported 584 additional confirmed COVID-19 cases Sunday, increasing its total to 579,877. The state's death toll remained at 6,640. Wisconsin reported that about 1.2 million residents have been fully vaccinated, or 20.1% of the population. In Illinois, there were 1,256,634 confirmed COVID-19 cases as of 5 p.m. Sunday, a 24-hour increase of 2,449. The state reported 12 more related deaths, increasing the death toll to 21,373. Illinois also reported about 2.4 million residents were fully vaccinated, 18.6% of the state's population. Next, Dubuque Church adapts to challenges of coronavirus to celebrate Easter. More than 200 people attend Easter service at Grandview Methodist, by Eric Hogstrom. The past year has meant months of adaptation for Reverend Tom Schinkel at Grandview United Methodist Church. When I think about last Easter, I think there was still hope last year with Easter, and then going into May, people were like, okay, I think this is going to be for a little while, and then boom. Boom, meaning the restrictions related to the COVID-19 pandemic, which upended normal life, including church worship, and sent Schinkel's congregation out of doors and online. Sunday, more than 200 people arrived at the church's front parking lot for an Easter morning service that reflected some of the adaptations made in the wake of the pandemic. Schinkel addressed the congregation from a pulpit set on top of a flatbed trailer parked between the church's front entrance and its parking lot. Singers, a band, and potted lilies shared the trailer with Schinkel, who spoke to dozens of people sitting in lawn chairs facing the trailer. Other people sat in their cars during the service. Some people don't want to get out of their cars, and that's fine, so they will tune into the radio, Schinkel said. Everything that is going through our sound system out here is going through the radio signal for two or three blocks. Marilyn Conklin, 93, of Dubuque, could hear the service fine while sitting in her car with the windows rolled down. I think this is a wonderful idea, Conklin said. I love being outdoors and having this service. Conklin said she felt much more positive this Easter compared to Easter 2020. Just being outdoors makes me positive, she said. Schinkel said life has opened up more this Easter compared to last. People are getting the vaccine. I've had both my shots and other people are getting their shots, so they are feeling more comfortable, he said. Shinkle's church began adapting to a pandemic reality a year ago. Last year, on April 12th, we did our first outdoor drive-in worship, and there was so much gratitude, Shinkle said. People were just genuinely happy to see each other and to worship with each other. Shinkle said the church continued to make adaptations throughout the summer and early fall. Early on, we basically said, "This is essential," so we started doing those adaptations. We held outdoor services until October when it got too cold. The church adapted inside as well. Because with our sanctuary, nothing is bolted down, we could space all of the chairs and the groupings, Shinkle said. That allowed us to safely come back together, and we continued to make those adaptations. I built plexiglass screens for our singers and had one myself. Drew Cook, 66, of Dubuque, credited Shinkle for helping church members overcome the challenges of the past year. He kept this together throughout the pandemic, Cook said. We live in a great world, and we're going to make it. Shinkle said every week, the church tinkers with its worship plans, inching closer to a more normal routine. Every week, we are adding something back safely, he said. Last week, we added back a paper bulletin. Next, from the Dubuque County News and Brief column, Rural Dubuque County Restaurant announces upcoming closure. Dateline Peosta, Iowa. A rural Dubuque County restaurant on Sunday announced its upcoming closing. Junction 21 will close on April 30th, according to an online announcement. The restaurant is located at 7653 Old Highway Road in rural Peosta. This was a difficult decision for both of us, but with everything we have going on, it was a choice that we made, the announcement stated. We are going to miss everyone that came to visit, whether it was to enjoy a crusher or the jumbo wings. We are going to start the process next week of running out of items, but we will do our best to keep the staples until the end. The latest iteration of Junction 21 opened in May 2018. Prior to that, it was open under different ownership from 2010 through February 2018. Next, live-streamed homecoming ceremony planned for returning Dubuque soldiers. Returning Iowa National Guard members will be honored with a live-streamed homecoming ceremony next week. The ceremony for about 130 members of the Iron Man 1st Battalion, 133rd Infantry Regiment, will be held April 13th at Dubuque Regional Airport, according to a press release. The time of the ceremony is to be determined. The release states that the ceremony is closed to the public due to COVID-19 related health concerns. The ceremony will be live streamed at facebook.com/ASSASSINS133INF. The Iron Man Battalion supported Operation Spartan Shield in the Middle East. Next, from the Tri-State page, Tri-State Maple Syrup Woes Part of National Story by Benjamin Fisher. The particularly precipitous winter, which just ended in the Tri-State region, coupled with atypical temperatures, have caused trouble with maple syrup harvests. Dubuque County Conservation usually looks forward to late winter or early spring, in part because it means it's maple tapping season. For the past 8 or so years, Conservation Director Brian Preston and his team have organized annual tree tapping and syrup boiling programs for youth education. The end product of these programs also serves as a big fundraiser for the department. But Preston said this winter's high snowpack helped make those programs just sweet memories. All of our maple trees are on our north-facing slopes, he told the Telegraph Herald. Because of the snow depth, it was just impossible to get to most of our trees until really late. Across the river in southwest Wisconsin, Lancaster-based backyard tree sapper Roger Lang said he had a similar problem just with access. I had so much snow that I couldn't really get to all my trees that I like to, he said. I have a little four-wheeler I carry buckets to the trees with, and I got stuck a couple of times. My son had to eventually use a snowmobile to kind of crush down a path for me. problems deepened with out-of-the-ordinary temperature levels. Typically, according to Preston, this shift in seasons bring big temperature fluctuations, but this year, the early sap season stayed too cold during the day. The late season, he said, stayed too warm at night. It needs warm days and cool nights for that pumping action to occur inside the tree, he said. These were traditional tap and bucket operations for sapping maples. The same problems were more easily avoided by Brian Wolf, owner of Big Timber Maple, one of the area's largest producers outside of Bankston. They recently switched to a vacuum system for their trees. So, Wolf said their season ended at record levels. But we did over double our amount of taps, he said. When it didn't freeze at night, we could get 4 or 5 days of sap flow where, for the bucket guys, the trees shut off. Anybody on a bucket got crushed. Wolf said the temperatures this year did lead to lower sugar content in the sap. He has been in contact with producers all over the, quote, sugar belt, end quote, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Vermont, and upstate New York. He said all reports are that production was very low nationwide. All eyes then, according to Wolf, are on Quebec, Canada's production season going on now. If they fail similarly, he said there could be another shortage. The COVID pandemic took sales up for everybody, he said. Everybody sold out. Historically, if the economy goes down, maple syrup goes up. That happened back in 2008. People have troubles and they want a little comfort food. Luckily, Preston said that his department does still have enough syrup from the previous winter to handle their needs. Folks can buy via links on the Swiss Valley Nature Center's Facebook page. Next, from the Lifestyle and Health page, COVID-19 vaccine cards. What to do if you lost it? Why you should laminate it? By Amy Hushka of the Detroit Free Press. Dateline Detroit. Maybe this goes without saying, but don't destroy or lose your COVID-19 vaccine card once you get it. In fact, you might want to take a picture of your card. It will last longer. Just make sure it's not a selfie. At your first vaccination appointment, you should have received a CDC vaccination card that tells you what COVID-19 vaccine you received, the date you received it, and where you received it. You will need to bring your vaccination card with you to your second vaccination appointment if you received the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. Johnson & Johnson is a one-shot vaccine. I lost my COVID-19 vaccine card. What do I do? If you did not receive a COVID-19 vaccination card at your first appointment, contact the vaccination provider site where you got your first shot or your state health department to find out how you can get a card. Same goes if you lost your vaccination card. If you cannot contact your vaccination provider directly, contact your state health department's immunization information system. Vaccination providers are required to report COVID-19 vaccinations to their IIS and related systems. The CDC recommends keeping your vaccination card in case you need it for future use, and to consider taking a picture of your vaccination card as a backup copy. And to keep your vaccination card even more secure, Office Depot and Office Max, they merged, will laminate your card for free until July 25th. Just don't forget to clip the coupon. Staples is joining in. The Hill reports Staples customers can use the coupon code 81450 to get their vaccine card laminated. CNN reports a company spokesperson said the service is available at all U.S. locations, does not yet have an end date. But just don't take a selfie with your vaccination card, according to consumer watchdogs. Unfortunately, your card has your full name and birthday on it, as well as information about where you got your vaccine, the Better Business Bureau warns. If your social media privacy settings aren't set high, you may be giving valuable information away for anyone to use. And your vaccination is even more valuable if you head to Krispy Kreme Donuts. From now until the end of 2021, you can get a free Krispy Kreme Original Glazed Donut when you show your vaccination card as proof. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, April 5th, 2021, on Iris, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Michael J. Buck Powers, age 68, of Dubuque, completed his earthly journey on April 3rd at Stonehill Care Center, surrounded by his loving family. To honor Mike's life, his celebration of life will be held on Wednesday, April 7th at 4 p.m. at Steeple Square, 101 East 15th Street in Dubuque, with Reverend Diane Grace officiating. Family and friends of Mike's may gather to visit from 2 to 4 p.m. at Steeple Square. Mike was born on April 16, 1952, in Dubuque, a son to Bill and Helen Laughlin Powers. He grew up surrounded by family and friends and quickly developed his athletic skills, which he would carry on throughout his life. He played on many teams over the years, but his love for the feel of the catcher's mitt on his hand never faded. Mike's love for the classroom also played an important role in his life. He spent many years as a teacher, but eventually embraced the role of principal at St. Mary's School in East Dubuque. Mike sadly had to move into retirement after 23 years of committed service due to health issues. Mike was an unshakable Hawkeye fan in his spare time, but whenever his Bears or Braves were playing, you could easily find him cheering them on as well. But at the end of the day, Mike would admit that being a faithfully devoted family man was where his true happiness was found. He always treasured the blessing of being a husband and father, and when the grandkids came into the picture, the joy he experienced was immeasurable. It's impossible to place into words the weight that sits upon our hearts today with the realization that Mike has been called home now. The legacy and memories which he leaves behind will hopefully help to heal the pain we feel, and we pray that he is resting peacefully in his Lord and Savior's arms until we meet again. Thank you, Mike, for leading by example and for continually teaching all of those you cared about that life is a journey to be lived to the fullest. Unfortunately, not always a smooth journey, but nonetheless, one worth taking. Mike's family would like to thank the nurses and staff at Stonehill and Hospice of Dubuque for all of their professional and compassionate care of Mike and his family. Online condolences may be shared with Mike's family at www.tristatecremationcenter.com. Next, today's listing of funeral services. Lucille E. Borman of Bellevue, Iowa. Funeral Mass at 11 a.m. today at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Bellevue. John E. Dottisman of Durango, Iowa. Visitation from 1 to 2:45 p.m. Wednesday, April 7th at Cheryl United Methodist Church in Cheryl. Memorial service at 3 p.m. at the church. Eileen G. Fisher of Des Moines. Visitation from 10 a.m. to noon today at St. Peter and Paul Catholic Church in Cheryl, Iowa. Mass of Christian burial at noon today at the church. Thomas J. Glob, Sr. of Dubuque. Visitation from 10 a.m. to noon today at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street. Services at noon today at the funeral home. Charles J. Henry of Long Beach, California. Memorial Mass at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, April 8th at St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade, Iowa. Lawrence G. Hofer of Cuba City, Wisconsin. Visitation from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. today at St. Rose of Lima Church in Cuba City. Funeral services at 11:30 a.m. today at the church. Dorothy H. Kohler of Potosi, Wisconsin. Visitation from noon to 1 p.m. today at St. Andrew Catholic Church in Tennyson, Wisconsin. Mass of Christian burial at 1 p.m. today at the church. Merlin J. Leake of Luxembourg, Iowa. Visitation from 9 to 10:45 a.m. Friday, April 9th at Holy Trinity Catholic Church in Luxembourg. Mass of Christian Burial at 11 a.m. at the church. Teresa A. Malloy of Dubuque. Visitation from 9 to 11 a.m. today at Resurrection Church in Dubuque. Mass of Christian Burial at 11 a.m. today at the church. Paul S. Smith of Kudahy, Wisconsin. A Mass of Christian Burial at 10 a.m. Tuesday, April 6th at St. Alphonsus Catholic Church. And Martin H. Werner of East Dubuque, Illinois. Visitation from 3 to 7 p.m. today at Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque. Mass of Christian Burial at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, April 6th at St. Mary's Church in East Dubuque, Illinois. Next, a couple stories from our nation page. Florida works to avoid catastrophic flood. Crews aim to prevent the collapse of a large wastewater pond by the Associated Press. Dateline Palmetto, Florida. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said Sunday that crews are working to prevent the collapse of a large wastewater pond in the Tampa Bay area while evacuating the area to avoid a catastrophic flood. Manatee County officials say the latest models show that a breach at the old phosphate plant reservoir has the potential to gush out at 340 million gallons of water in a matter of minutes, risking a 20-foot-high wall of water. What we are looking at now is trying to prevent and respond to, if need be, a real catastrophic flood situation, DeSantis said at a press conference after flying over the old Piney Point phosphate mine. Authorities have closed off portions of U.S. Highway 41 and ordered evacuations of 316 homes. Some families were placed in local hotels. Manatee County Sheriff's officials began evacuating about 345 inmates from a local jail about a mile away from the 77-acre pond first floor on Sunday afternoon, the Tampa Bay Times reported. Manatee County Administrator Scott Hopes said models show the area could be covered with between 1 to 5 feet of water, and the second floor is 10 feet above the ground. Officials first announced that they would move people and staff to the second story and put sandbags on the ground floor, but Sheriff Rick Wells later said moving all the inmates to the second floor posed a security risk. County officials say well water remains unaffected and there is no threat to Lake Manatee, the area's primary source of drinking water. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection said the water in the pond is primarily salt water mixed with wastewater and storm water. It has elevated levels of phosphorus and nitrogen and is acidic, but not expected to be toxic, the agency says. Crews have been discharging water since the pond began leaking in March. On Friday, a significant leak was detected, escalating the response and prompted the first evacuations and a declaration of a state of emergency on Saturday. Next, with Jolt of Aid, schools eye solutions to old, new problems. Windfall of assistance will help ease the harm of the pandemic and more, by Colin Binkley of the Associated Press. With a massive infusion of federal aid coming their way, schools across the U.S. are weighing how to use the windfall to ease the harm of the pandemic and to tackle problems that existed long before the coronavirus. The assistance that was approved last month totals $123 billion, a staggering sum that will offer some districts several times the amount of federal education funding they receive in a single year. The aid will help schools reopen and expand summer programs to help students catch up on learning. It also offers a chance to pursue programs that have long been seen as too expensive, such as intensive tutoring, mental health services, and major curriculum upgrades. This feels like a once-in-a-generation opportunity for us to be able to make critical investments, said Nathan Cooter, Chief Financial Officer of Boston Public Schools, which is expecting $275 million. But the spending decisions carry high stakes. If important needs are overlooked, or if the money does not bring tangible improvements, schools could face blowback from their communities and from politicians who influence their funding. At the same time, schools must be wary of dreaming too big and taking on long-term costs they cannot sustain. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said the assistance allows schools to hit the reset button and confront challenges that have long plagued the nation's education system. He said schools can train teachers in social and emotional learning and work to close persistent racial disparities in education. With successful implementation, our students are going to have a better experience than they did before the pandemic, Cardona said in an interview. Districts with higher concentrations of poverty will get the largest sums. Public schools in some cities are expected to receive more than $1 billion, including Los Angeles and Philadelphia. The new money joins more than $67 billion made available to schools in other relief packages during the pandemic. Schools must reserve 20% for summer programs and other efforts to address learning loss, but they expect to have wide flexibility in how to use most of the aid. With more than 3 years to spend the new money, school leaders are thinking big. Officials in Boston say the aid will be used to reopen, recover, and reimagine what is possible for our students, Cooter said. The money will help update aging buildings, but it could also be used to start new dual language programs or revamp the curriculum, he said. Next, from the sports page, under United States Hockey League, Kurth, a quick study. Fighting Saints rookie makes immediate impact, earns invite to BioSteel All-American Game, by Jim Leitner. Connor Kurth could always score, but he came to the mature conclusion that, in order to succeed in the upper levels of hockey, he needed to develop into a more complete player. He found the perfect environment to round out his game this season under coach Oliver David and the Dubuque Fighting Saints. The 5'11", 214-pound right wing from Elk River, Minnesota, ranks fifth in USHL rookie scoring with 13 goals and 32 points through 43 games and put himself on the radar for NHL Central scouting in his first year of draft eligibility. On Wednesday, he will continue a Saints legacy by competing in the BioSteel All-American Game at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, Michigan. Coming to the USHL has made a huge difference in my game, Kurth said Saturday night. Coach David has taught me so much, especially in how to play without the puck, because that was an aspect of my game that I really needed to work on before I came to Dubuque. The coaches have shown me so many little details that I'd never seen before, and I can tell I've just skyrocketed in that part of my game. Because of that, my confidence is head over heels better than it was at the beginning of the year. I go out there every night, and I'm not nervous. I'm just excited to play, ready to play, and I'm not scared of whoever I'm out there against. And I trust Coach David has me in the right spot. Kurth, a University of Minnesota recruit who won't turn 18 until July 30th, tallied 30 goals and 70 points in just 20 games for the Gentry Academy under-16 AAA team last season. The previous season, he put up 28 goals and 58 points in 27 games split between the under-15 and under-14 AAA levels. On November 6th, in his first game with Dubuque, Kurth recorded a hat trick in a 7-4 loss to Muskegon. He led the team in scoring for several weeks before settling into his current spot at third. He made an immediate impact with us, which is a really tough thing to do for a 17-year-old in this league, David said. But he can really shoot the puck, and he has a knack for finding the back of the net. He's a well-built young man who's strong and a powerful skater. Stepping up a level helped him early on. Because of the start we had, all of our young guys had an opportunity to play through the learning curve of stepping up into the USHL. Ultimately, it benefited them tremendously. Saints general manager Kyle Larson and David opted to begin the season with seven 17-year-old players after rostering only three last season. The challenge became steeper for the rookies in 2020-21 because nearly every other USHL team returned college-ready players who opted for another season in the USHL, rather than facing the uncertainty of freshman seasons in a coronavirus-impacted NCAA Division I season. In late December, after a 1-10-0 start, Larson began to overhaul the roster and brought in five impact players: goaltender Lucas Perrick, defenseman Zane Dempsey, and forwards Andre Bojalski, Matt Savoy, and John Evans, all without sacrificing prospects or draft picks. NCAA-tested defenseman Henry Thrun returned to the team after helping USA Hockey win the World Junior Championships because Harvard opted not to have a season. "That influx of talent has been huge for our team," Kurth said. "We brought in some guys who really know how to play hockey and how to score goals, which has been a big thing for all of us. But for me, personally, adding more depth and more goals took some pressure off, and I was able to execute with those guys a little better." For the most part, Kurth avoided the wall that many rookies hit when the USHL reaches the dog days of the season. He hasn't gone more than four games without registering at least 1 point. "When the grind kicks in, production tends to go away a little bit," David said. "But he's had a very stable character the entire way through the season, and it's a testament to him that he's been consistent. He's been attentive to the many learning opportunities that present themselves, and now he has a new understanding of the other aspects of the game that complement his skill set and will continue to make his game even more threatening as he continues this season and when he ultimately moves up levels. Learning the game without the puck and learning when to make plays, when to hang on to the puck, shot selection versus scanning for a teammate, all of those things have improved tremendously. One reward for his attention to detail will come Wednesday night. Ultimately, he's well built and has a very healthy family unit and support network," David said. "That's a big part of why he's earned recognition with NHL Central Scouting. His selection to the All-American game is testament to that." The BioSteel All-American game features two teams of the top American-born prospects eligible for the 2021 NHL Draft. Kurth will play for the USHL squad against the National Team Development Program's Under 18 squad. The BioSteel All-American game has featured more than 200 NHL draft picks, including 46 total first-round selections since its inception in 2012. The event did not take place in 2019. "I was really thankful to hear that I made the game," said Kurth, who has leaned on teammate Daniel Zahaniev for advice on the event. "It's a really big honor for me. I obviously wouldn't be in this position without my awesome teammates who have helped me out a lot the whole season. Talking to Danny about playing in it last year, I know it's going to be an exciting time and a lot of fun. It'll be a little different because we only get two or three practices and we're playing a game against a team that has been together all year. We just have to buy into whatever our coaches want us to do and try to play that system as well as we can." Next, under Final Four, Baylor versus Gonzaga. Gonzaga faces one final hurdle: "Only Baylor stands in way of perfect season," by Eddie Pels of the Associated Press, Dateline Indianapolis. Now comes the hard part for Gonzaga. Less than 16 hours after walking off the floor with one of the most scintillating wins in the game's history, the barely still undefeated Bulldogs returned to the practice court Sunday to get ready for the national championship game. Their opponent, Baylor, is rested, ready, and waiting for a challenge. The meeting tonight is one most Hoops fans have waited for all year, 2 years really, a matchup between two teams who have been on a collision course since the bracket came out. No need for extra motivation here. But how do the Zags move on after that? "It's a lot in 30 hours, but it is what it is," Gonzaga coach Mark Few said. My guys have been great at game preparations all season, so consistent with effort and the attention to detail on game night. So we're definitely banking on that. To recap, Jalen Suggs banked in a shot from a step inside the midcourt line at the buzzer to lift the Zags to a 93-90 overtime victory over UCLA. The game ended after 11 p.m. Saturday. By the time that happened, Baylor, 27-2, was back at the hotel. We were probably like everyone else on the eighth floor of the hotel, Baylor coach Scott Drew said of their reaction to the shot. Pandemonium erupted. The Bears rolled over Houston 78-59, and suddenly they look every bit as unbeatable as the unbeaten Bulldogs 31-0. No team has come closer than 9 points of Baylor over the 3 weeks in Indianapolis. Games lost. This matchup has been a long time in the making. Had the COVID-19 pandemic not washed out the 2020 postseason, both these teams would have been number one seeds in last season's NCAA tournament. They were supposed to play this season too. The meeting was set for December 5th in Indianapolis, a Final Four preview in the Final Four city, many predicted, but the game got scratched when a Zags player and a staffer tested positive. The coaches worked hard to try to reschedule, but there was no room on the calendar. Instead, they meet for the title. This marks the first time since 2005 that the top two teams on the overall seeding list have faced in the final. Gonzaga has spent the entire season at number one in the AP poll. Baylor spent 15 of 17 weeks at number two and finished at number three behind Illinois. Mo's moment. Nobody will ever forget Adam Morrison's tears against UCLA. Now, nobody will forget his yes. The former Gonzaga star was crestfallen, weeping with his head buried in the hardwood after a devastating loss to the Bruins in the Sweet 16 back in 2006. 15 years later, he does color for Bulldogs Radio, and his reaction to Suggs' game winner was getting plenty of buzz a day later. It's three loud shouts of yes, with some other hooting and hollering to wrap it up. Coach Few said the team's sports information director played it for him on the way over to do his interviews Sunday. A pretty special moment, and I was happy for him and proud of him for letting his guard down, the coach said, prior to the pause. Before COVID put a three-week hold on their season in February, the Bears were undefeated too. After starting 18-0, they lost 2 of 6 shortly after coming out of the break. Drew said the lack of quality practice time during the layoff, then afterward when Baylor was playing almost every other day, took its toll on the team's defense. Only when the Bears lost to Oklahoma State in the Big 12 tournament semifinal were they able to get back to practicing regularly and get back to basics. Our players really bought in, Drew said. Our defense was lapsing, and we had to get back to where we were. Analytics ranked the Bears third in the nation in forced turnovers and sixth in steals, part of the formula for stopping Gonzaga's top-ranked offense. Prime matchup. Baylor's Davion Mitchell's nickname is Off Night, because anyone he D's up on seems to have one. His next task? Stopping Suggs. In addition to making the shot of the tournament, Suggs is averaging 14 points and 5.5 rebounds a game and setting himself up as an NBA lottery pick should he decide to leave. Mitchell says he knows he can't shut down anyone completely. My job is just to slow him down, not to keep him from scoring, Mitchell said. Everyone's really good at this game. My job is just to limit that. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, April 5th, 2021. I'm your reader, Ralph Skippers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. As always, thanks for listening, and be safe.